Kim wanted me to tell you that she's still mad that you called our kids ugly,
it.
like 2 episodes ago.
Your kids are actually, not that this is recording now, not you know, but to get this record straight, your kids are actually, knowing that they have half of your genes, it's pretty surprising how attractive your children are.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Sorry, Kim. Sawadi, welcome to a special Thai-flavored edition of the George Sanders Show. Today we will be discussing Hong Kong director Chang Chae's Bangkok-set kung fu boxing film, Duel of Fists, as well as the melodramatic pop art quasi-western Tears of the Black Tiger, from Thai director Wisit Sasanatiang. In addition, we will run down our choices for the best 2013-ish films at this, the halfway point of the year, as well as our Cinema Essential selections for best kung fu film. Throughout the show, we'll be hearing selections from the great compilation Thai Pop Spectacular, released by Seattle record label Sublime Frequencies. With me, as always, is the Singhai beer to my Penang curry, Sean Gilman. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
My name is Mike, and I think it's time we got this party started with a discussion of the 1971 film Duel of Fists. That was a clip from Duel of Fists, Chang Chae's 1971 kung fu film, which is actually set in Thailand. He's a Hong Kong director, and it's a Shaw Brothers film, but they went across the way and filmed this in Bangkok. And it's the story of an engineer with kung fu abilities who finds out from his dying father that he has a half-brother who is a Thai boxer, and his father's final wish before he passes is that these two brothers meet. So he heads to Bangkok, and he's got just the slightest bit of information. He knows his brother's a boxer, he knows that he has a certain tattoo on his arm, and so he tries to track him down. And meanwhile, his brother is a very upstanding, good guy who is being kind of cajoled by the mob to kind of take a dive and throw a fight, but he refuses to do that because he's good-hearted, and that his he needs to win because his mother needs an operation.
Right. It's the barest sketch of a plot in a movie that most of the time just feels like a Chang Chae just took his Shaw Brothers crew on vacation in Thailand and they decided to make a movie while they were there to help pay their expenses.
Yeah, it very much it feels like a travelogue too at times. I think there are like three shots where Chang, zooms in on the words Bangkok Airport.
Yeah, and there's they go and have lunch at the the Siam International Hotel.
Exactly.
And there are very pretty shots of the hotel as they go in, and like the interesting architecture of the restaurant. And,
yeah,
and they go and do some like tourist activities.
Yeah, it didn't overdo that stuff. I was kind of concerned when they would, there's a scene where, you know, this girl is going to show him the sights, you know, yeah. And I was like, oh, here comes the travel montage. And it is kind of a travel montage, but it's short and it's, you know,
they go to a temple and it's like it's a really lazy travelogue because they only go like three different places and most of them are like places they were at anyway, like the airport or the hotel where the cast and crew was probably staying.
Yeah, it's true. What I do like about the, you know, you said barest of plots, I do like the narrative economy here, especially in the very beginning when they're still in Hong Kong and they have to set up the whole plot going forward. And, you know, it's literally like a minute of screen time between him reminding his father of his father's heart condition. He says, but father, you can't go to Thailand. You have a heart condition. And then literally like 60 seconds later, his father's on his deathbed in a hospital, having had a heart attack. And then his father, you know, has this wish for him to, you know, fulfill this request of his. And the doctor, I think that doesn't the doctor tell him, don't disobey your father.
Listen to what he has to say and don't disobey him.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, well now the plot's in motion, you know, which is like the first, 5 minutes of the film or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, there's very little in the way of establishing these as distinct characters. They pretty much rely on the persona of the stars who, you know, have been working with Chang for a while. And that kind of narrative economy and efficiency is you see a lot in Shaw Brothers, and it's because they modeled their production style on Hollywood studios in the 30s and 40s, which also have really tightly constructed plots, and there's very little in extraneous information. It's got a star system with established character types, and you know, each movie is just kind of going through the motions of these elaborately set up ahead of time genre templates.
Right.
The pleasure of watching a Shaw Brothers movie and a Hollywood studio movie are the little areas where the movies differ from the generic template.
Mm-hmm.
There's not so much of that in Duel of Fists. It's pretty much just a straightforward sports movie where like the boxer is told to take a dive and he doesn't want to, and then, you know, they defeat the bad guys.
Yeah.
But it's a kung fu movie, so they defeat them by kicking their ass.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's actually, there's not too much, like, there's the opening scene where we discover that he has the kung fu skills, but there's not much kung fu until the last 20 minutes or so, because so much of the film is taken up with these boxing scenes.
Right. It's Thai boxing or Muay Thai fighting, which is different from kung fu. It's basically a martial art designed around hitting people with your elbows and your knees.
Yeah,
and it's really brutal.
It's very brutal.
Yeah.
And for me, well, number one, I'm not a big sports fan except for baseball. And two, I particularly don't care for boxing that much. And so for me, with Duel of Fists, the boxing scenes, except the final one, for me, kind of blurred together. They were kind of tedious, and they seemed like they took up too much screen time, especially because you don't know who's fighting, especially in the first fight, you don't know who's fighting who. You don't know anything about these people. The final boxing match between our hero and the villainous, what's his name?
Cannon.
Cannon, that's right, Cannon.
The boxer who kills people in the ring.
Yeah, he's brutal.
He's the tool of the gangster.
Yeah, and that, for some reason, I think a combination of the fact that you do know who these two characters are, because we've seen the dramatic, you know, episodes with them previously in the film. And then I also think Chang is invested more in the film. Like, the filmmaking is a little different in that fight, too. It seems a little more in your face, like it's much more up close, and kind of more kinetic in that final battle, which I was really caught up in that one. I thought it was very well done.
In the final boxing match?
Yeah, the final boxing match.
Yeah, the first time we see a fight, the initial shot of it is in long shot from like overhead. It takes place in like a boxing ring that looks just like an American boxing ring. But
right.
The view is from like up in the stands, so you're looking down on the fight and you can't really make out the characters. You're just kind of seeing them beat the crap out of each other. later on, he puts you more into the fight with, like, a handheld camera that's not, like, a shaky cam, like a Hollywood thing where it's trying to hide stuff, but it's more just actually kind of putting you
directly in
the action.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not, like, a POV of the fighter or something like that.
Right.
It's still more involved in the action, and that's fairly typical of Chang and the way he was shooting action scenes in the late 60s and 70s. We should probably talk a bit about Chang Che, because I don't know is this the first Chang Che movie you've seen?
I'm pretty sure it is. I mean, I saw a number of, and I think we're going to talk about Kung Fu later in the show. I've seen a number of those Shaw Brothers films, most of them 15 years ago on VHS, and so I may have seen a Chang Che film, but I wouldn't be able to tell you what it was.
Kind of his first big hit was The One-Armed Swordsman with Jimmy Wang Yu.
Yeah, I've not
who
seen that.
Plays a swordsman who gets his arm cut off and learns to fight.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first big of the new wave of Kung Fu movies that came around in the late 60s. It was big hits along with King Hu's Come Drink With Me. Just kind of started this new Shaw Brothers cycle. He also did Golden Swallow, which is kind of a loose sequel to Come Drink With Me, Return of the One-Armed Swordsman, and Duel of Fists are all kind of within this 5-year period. They're all choreographed by Lau Kar-Lung,
mm-hmm.
who went on to do 36 Chamber of Shaolin. And we talked about him on the first episode when he had just died. But he did the fight choreography for Chang Che's films. As Chang went on, his movies became like increasingly brutal and increasingly obsessed with this idea of like camaraderie between two men. He does another movie with that stars David Chang and Tae Leung called Blood Brothers,
mm-hmm.
in which these warriors kind of have a code that they have to follow, and one of them violates the code, and so the movie becomes about punishing him for this violation of the code. And this kind of concept gets explored in a whole bunch of his movies in the 70s, and it was a huge influence on John Woo.
Mm-hmm.
A Better Tomorrow, which kind of started the new wave of these, they're called heroic bloodshed movies, which is a really bad name for a genre. But it stars Chow Yun-Fat and Tae Leung, the star of Duel of Fists. He's much older and has much less hair, but he's Chow Yun-Fat's partner, and they have this code of conduct between them and between gangsters, and the violations of the code become the drivers of the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes like a main John Woo theme in The Killer and Hard Boiled, and then Johnny To picks it up in the late 90s.
I knew Johnny To was going to make an appearance.
Johnny To makes an appearance. Many of his crime movies are about the same theme that Chang Che initially started exploring in the late 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
None of that is in Duel of Fists. Like, they're literally brothers, but any kind of code that they follow is just more of a kind of generic, I gotta, get this operation for my mom.
Right.
Which, Tae Leung's mom needs an operation. We don't know what kind of operation.
Nope.
We don't know why she's sick. When we do see her, she has like two lines and she's like lying on a hospital bed.
Yeah.
So we never actually, see the interaction with the mom.
Yeah.
It's just
a plot device.
It's just totally artificial and just a structure
mm-hmm.
for the Thai boxing, which is the real kind of highlight of the film, and then the kind of Thai boxing versus kung fu fighting that you get in the finale, where David Chang, somewhat unbelievably, manages to beat up everyone and start like pulling out their ribs.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It's pretty superficial, the whole movie. There are some parts about that superficial nature of it that I like, insofar as like there's I like the sets, like the set in the beginning of the film when he's proving to the audience that he is in fact an engineer. He goes
to his dad's house and his dad's a kung fu master, and as he's like wearing his suit and tie,
right,
and the other students just suddenly start attacking him
for no reason. Like, he walks in the door and like 20 guys come out of nowhere and just start attacking him, and he just I mean, he doesn't kill them because they're friends, but, you know, they kind of spar.
It's a friendly a brawl.
But he kicks everybody's ass, you know. So that can be fun, you know. But, yeah, it's a movie where, you know, I watched the movie 5 days ago. Very little of it is still in my head, you know. There are little bits here and there that I'll probably, you know.
Yeah, it's really unusual for Chang because most of his movies have like these scenes and images that really stick with you. Mm-hmm. They're also, this is the first one I've seen of his that has a contemporary setting. They're almost all period movies. Mm. Yeah, I mean, it really feels like a movie that they did on vacation.
Yeah.
It's like they just took some time off and maybe the Shaw brothers were like, hey, we want to, you know, we're trying to open these theaters and get our movies to play in Thailand.
Right.
Chang, why don't you take your crew and go over there and make a movie?
Yeah,
and over 2 weeks they made a movie and they put it out.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it could have been the business kind of necessitated the film or whatever.
Yeah, I'm making it sound really cheap and lazy, but I actually think it's kind of fun. Like I like when people who like working together just kind of get together and make a movie for the fun of it. And you know, this movie has that kind of laid back, we're on vacation, let's just screw around kind of vibe to it, and I enjoy that. It looks like they're having fun in Thailand.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the movie just fine. There was nothing in there that I detested or you know, rubbed me the wrong way. You know, I mean, like I said, the boxing scenes became a little tedious, you know, the frequency of them and the length of them. But other than that, you know, it's a entirely pleasant picture. And speaking of it being a contemporary film for Chang, what's so great about watching it now, you know, 40 years, you know, away from it, is seeing the 1970s look. I mean, those outfits are just off the wall. I mean, this disco cowboy look that's going on.
Yeah, David Chang. He's in Hong Kong. He's set up as an engineer, and he's wearing a suit and tie.
Very very conservative suit and tie.
He's a businessman. His dad wants him to go to Thailand, and he's like, "No, I'm an engineer. I have this job." And his dad, what's the line you quoted on Letterboxd that his dad says?
His dad says to him, "There are plenty of engineers in the world, but not many with the kung fu skills that you possess," or something like that.
Let one of the other engineers do your job.
Yeah, I need your kung fu skills.
So he's like this, you know, conservative engineer guy.
Yeah.
But then as soon as he steps off the plane in Bangkok, he's wearing like this white, you know, Stetson hat, and he's got like a vest with fringe on it.
Like,
and he's walking around
polka dot bell bottoms or something. I mean,
and he changes his clothes so often. Like, I started to like track the amount of the clothing changes that he would go through because they didn't make sense in the plot. Like at one point he's off with the girl and they're having dinner and he's like, I want to go see the fight because T-Long's going to be in a fight and he's friends with T-Long. And she's like, okay, let's go now. But when they get to the arena, they're both wearing different outfits. So I'm like, did they go back to the hotel and change? Why didn't they go straight there?
Right.
Well, but no, it's just because he needed to show off his new threads.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. And also, you know, you get to see the cool cars, you know, that they're driving around.
I love the girl that he meets with the car. Like, he jumps on her car.
Well, she almost hits him.
Yeah, she almost hits him. So he jumps on her car, does like a somersault to land on the hood of her car. And he's like, I'm trying to follow that car. And she's like, okay.
Yeah, well, and then she's like,
do you mind? And he says, do you mind if I drive? No, go ahead.
she just lets
him drive her car.
Yep.
And then they chase around and get in a fight, and you know, then she keeps hanging around with him. You know, it's the 70s.
Yeah, why not? Hey. You know, it's all fair game. So yeah, it's a swinging, you know, goofy little picture, but it's fun. There are a couple of moments though, and they're very fleeting, and but there's a moment. I think my favorite part of the whole movie is during the final boxing match, and the girlfriend of our hero, she doesn't want him to fight. You know,
right.
because she knows Cannon's reputation.
Yeah,
she knows,
she's a one note character. She's the You see this, and she's a cliche in sports movies. She's the girlfriend who doesn't want the guy to compete anymore.
Right.
She's a drag.
She is a drag. But I think my favorite part of the whole movie is you're getting this very brutal boxing match between the two of them, you know, the climactic boxing match. And it's in close, and you hear the cheering from the crowd, and you hear these, you know, just visceral punches and kicks, just, you know, crunching bones and stuff. And then Chang, for, you know, 5 seconds, cuts to her outside on the steps,
mm-hmm.
and it's just totally silent, and it's just her standing there looking away from the boxing stadium, you know, just very, you know, nerve-wracked and just, you know, concerned. And it's just this quiet moment, you know, and then he throws you right back into that boxing match, and it's just, like, pummeling and brutal and stuff. And then he does the same thing at the end of that match, when everybody's cheering because our hero has won, and they're going off out of the boxing arena, and there's that drunk guy, the alcoholic.
Yeah, I love that character.
Yeah, that guy's really cool.
He's a former fighter who got hit one too many times, and now he's an alcoholic.
Yeah, and he just lingers around the boxing arena, you know, begging for change and just getting really wasted. And it shows them all moving off into their future. You know, he's quit boxing because he won, and they're moving on. And he stays there as the crowd leaves, and he just, like, sits down on the steps in front of the boxing arena
with his bottle of booze.
Yeah, and those two quiet moments were really, really interesting, and I really like those things. And I guess the movie could have done more with those things, or done more of them, should I say?
Yeah, and you know, when I say what you're looking for in a generic film that's a product of a studio system, when you're looking for the small moments, the small distinctive things that are kind of the signature of the director, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That kind of the camera lingering on the aging fighter as he sits down after everyone has gone off cheering, you know, that's the kind of special moment that a great director will put into a typical genre film. You know, if you're just watching, you know, generic Z-grade boxing movie, you're not going to get a moment like that.
Right. Yeah, it's, these things are just so tantalizing, and they spark your brain into thinking about, you know, different avenues and, like, side stories that could be going on, you know, concurrent to the main picture, and it really fleshes out the world of what, you know, what's going on in this film, and I really do enjoy little things like that. So
yeah, you know, Chang's better movies are more full of moments like that.
Yeah.
It becomes more of an actual theme that's developed in the movie as opposed to just a tiny moment.
Yeah, just tossed out the little thing.
So, yeah, if you're going to watch a Chang Chang movie, I would not recommend starting with Duel of Fists. it's a fun movie, but it's not a great one. I would go with The One-Armed Swordsman. My favorite of his movies is from 1978. It's called Crippled Avengers. Also known as Return of the Five Deadly Venoms. Five Deadly Venoms is probably his most famous movie. It's these five guys, and it plays out more like a detective movie than an actual, like, kung fu film. I think it's kind of boring, but Crippled Avengers, which is not really a sequel, but it has the same cast, which is why it's called the
mm-hmm. Return.
The Return.
But they're not the same characters.
Not the same characters at all.
They're not like Captain America in a wheelchair, right?
No. Okay. Well, kind of. there are these guys who have been victimized and crippled by the villain, and then they learn new kung fu skills that make turn their handicaps into advantages, and then they take on the bad guy. And it's got some of, like, the most brutal fight sequences I've ever seen. Like, really, you know, kind of extended violent scenes. They're a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, I look
but
forward
to it. It's not just, you know, I'm being flippant. It's not just fun. It's, you know, it's kind of a serious examination of, like, the violence and brutality of the kind of world that exists in kung fu movies.
Well, you had me at the title Crippled Avengers. So.
Yeah. That's a great movie. He made lots of other great movies, too. So.
Well, that's great. I wouldn't steer people away from Duel of Fists. You know, I mean,
it's perfectly fine. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's Duel of Fists. We are going to take a quick break, This is we'll be playing the first song from Thai Pop Spectacular here. This is Onuma Singsiri with Papaya Salad Merchant, and we will be right back with news and our best 2013-ish films.
ปั๊มปากซอยน้องน้าขายส้มตำหนุ่มแท็กซี่รูปหล่อและหนุ่มสามล้อมาอุดหนุนประจำแต่คืนนี้ยังไม่เห็นพี่มาแต่คืนนี้ยังไม่เห็นพี่มาหรือว่าพี่ยาเปลี่ยนที่กินส้มตำส้มตำน้องคงไม่อร่อยไม่เหมือนแถวซอยสุขิสานตรอกตามหนุ่มแท็กซี่เลยเพื่ออัดไปติดสาวเนื้อที่ขายเพียงคำหนุ่มสามล้อก็ไม่เห็นมีแววหนุ่มสามล้อก็ไม่เห็นมีแววเคยมาจีบเจ้าเจ้าแต่กินเงียบงำแม่ค้าส้มตำอีสานหัวใจไว้หวั่นเสียหัวแต่หัวคำหนุ่มแท็กซี่ไม่มากินส้มตำ
All right, thanks, Onuma. We are back on the George Sanders Show, and it's the middle of July here. It's also the middle of 2013, and it seems like everyone else is posting their best movies of the year so far lists, because it's the dead of summer and a lot of blockbusters are coming out and they're not fun to write about because they're all kind of terrible. So people need content and lists fill content requirements.
And we're not above that.
And we are certainly not above that here on the George Sanders Show. What we are above, however, is calling 2012 movies 2013 movies. Because whether or not a movie played in a theater near us in a year does not mean that the movie was
a 2013 film. Right.
We are both of the opinion that a movie should be dated to the year it premiered before an audience, whether a festival audience, whether an audience in Thailand, an audience in Sweden, or an audience in our local multiplex.
Right.
The year is the year. So with that said, we haven't seen very many 2013 movies.
I've seen four.
I've seen one. And then I saw a miniseries, which you could count as a movie because it played theatrically at Sundance.
Ah.
And that's it for me. So what we're going to do here is we're going to count down the best 2012 movies of 2013. These are the movies that premiered last year, but they didn't become available at a theater near us until this year. So they're the movies that people are mostly populating their best of the year so far lists.
Yeah, and you know, I would have included a true official 2013 movie that I'd seen had it been as good as the top five that I have here. But nothing that I've seen that's actually a 2013 film. And I have a list on Letterboxd that I update as I see movies from this year and from last year that we can link to in the show. You know. And yeah, nothing that an official 2013 film comes close to any of the top five that I have here.
Yeah, I put a top 10 list up on my blog, and of the top five, two of them were movies that I saw in the theater this year that just got released this year. Mm-hmm. The other three I saw at the Vancouver Film Festival last year.
Yeah, that's almost a full year.
Yeah, almost a year ago.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's go ahead and you tell us your top five.
Okay. Number five is Room 237, which is a great little documentary about people's whacked out theories about Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. Just super, super fun and hilarious movie about people being full of themselves. And number four is Terrence Malick's To the Wonder, which is a really interesting film that I'm looking forward to seeing again. I think it's probably his most divisive film, or at least it is in my household, where my girlfriend, who loves Terrence Malick, Really did not care for To the Wonder, but I thought it was really striking, and like I said, I'm interested to watch it again. Number three is Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, his black and white adaptation of the Shakespeare play that he filmed at his house over the course of 2 weeks.
Speaking of movies made while on vacation.
Exactly. There you go, tying it in to this show. That's super fun, great performances, and just a light and breezy film. Number two is a film you may have not seen, Sean. It's called Drug War by a director named Johnny To.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah, it's coming. I think it's coming out around here in about a week or two, and it's pretty good. And number one is a really fantastic film. I saw at SIFF, I think in March. Blanca Nieves, which is a Spanish black and white silent film that's way better than The Artist. It's a retelling of Snow White.
Well, that's not saying much.
No, it's not. I think almost every movie that I've seen in 2013. that didn't make this list is better than The Artist too, but Blanca Nieves is really great. It's Snow White set in the world of matadors, and it's just a really great throwback, and it's very melodramatic, and the performances are great. The whole thing is just a blast. So that's my number one pick.
All right, my number five is Hong Sang-soo's In Another Country, which is now, it's not his latest movie, because he had Nobody's Daughter, Haewon, premiered earlier this year, and now he's got another one premiering at a film festival in a couple of weeks, so it's like his third to most recent film. It stars Isabelle Huppert as a French woman who goes to Korea and has, you know, three different stories, and they're all kind of interconnected, and it's a lot of fun. It's another great vacation movie, and Hong is one of the best filmmakers at depicting vacations in the history of cinema. Number four also is To the Wonder, the Terrence Malick movie. I think it's a lot better. I think it's gotten a bum rap as, you know, just being about twirling. I think there's a lot more depth to it and a lot going on, and Ben Affleck doesn't ruin it. My number three is Drug War, which we discussed on the first episode of the George Sanders Show. Be sure to go and re-download and re-listen to that when it comes out in a couple of weeks. My number two is Raul Ruiz's final film, Night Across the Street, which is really hard to describe. It's about an old guy who's kind of near death, and he has a kind of an odd fantasy life where he interacts with literary characters, and he thinks the guy is trying to kill him, and it's a crazy movie, but it's really fun. And my number one is Abbas Kiarostami's film in Japan, Like Someone in Love, about a young call girl and her getting mixed up with an old professor, and it's about people pretending to be like other people, like they're in love, and they're like barriers and windows, and it all gets shattered, and it's great.
That's great. Yeah, I look forward to seeing all of those films. I wanted to see Like Someone in Love when it was here, and I just missed out.
I'd just like to point out that it was my idea to have short, pithy comments describing the movies, and I'm completely incapable of doing so.
That's right. I was willing to just talk forever, but Sean, you know, discouraged me. I think you're just trying to hog the show is what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Okay, well, those are our best 2012 movies that most people are seeing now, so check them out. So in other news, I think the big film to do this week, someone created a Tumblr, where they're showcasing how a lot of films on Netflix are being cropped from their original, you know, frame.
They're being cropped from the 2.35 CinemaScope widescreen frame to fit 16:9.
Right, exactly. And Netflix is swearing that they didn't do it, which is a load of malarkey.
Well, no, it's true. They didn't do it. It's the studios. Netflix just plays what the distributors give them, and what the distributors give them are these versions of the movies that have been formatted for pay TV, for like HBO or Stars or Showtime, and those are 16:9. They recut the movies in order to fit people to widescreen TVs, because people don't know how movies work.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the same thing when stuff started being you know,
panned and scanned.
Panned and scanned and all those things. Just because people feel like it needs to fill every inch of the available space on the screen, who cares if it cuts someone's head off or stretches their face to, you know, unbelievable
It drives me nuts. I, like, I go to my in-laws' house and they have a 16 by 9 TV, but they're not, like, paying for, like, the HD cable signal. So they're just putting the regular TV on there, but then they're stretching it so it fills the 16 by 9. And, yeah, like, all the baseball players look like Babe Ruth. And, you know, they're so fat. Yeah. Doesn't that bother you? Like, I don't know.
What? Yeah, it fills the screen. Yeah, and you see also whenever you go to, like, a bar or, you know, some sort of establishment that has something
on it. Yeah, whenever I go to a hotel, it's always set to stretch. I always reprogram the TV.
Oh, so that was you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a really unfortunate practice, regardless of who's doing it, whether it's the viewer themselves or the studio providing it or the distribution company. These things are art. You know, some of them are terrible art, but they're art, and they should be respected by their, you know, their creator's vision and how it's supposed to be seen. And, you know, it's, you know, if you take something like Lawrence of Arabia and you just zoom in on Lawrence and get rid of all of the, you know, scenery behind him, you're not watching Lawrence of Arabia, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, we're about to start talking about Kung Fu movies, and this is a big issue for me with Kung Fu movies is that people don't take them seriously, and it becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. Like, when the movies initially came out in the US, they were recut and they were really badly dubbed, and they'd be shown on, like, Saturday afternoon TV, and they'd just be, oh, look at the stupid Kung Fu movies, you killed my master, I will kill you. Just kind of nonsense. And so, you know, people didn't take them seriously. They're just like these cheap, cheesy action movies.
Yeah.
So that mentality persists, you know, even 30 years later when, you know, we've actually, you know, discovered that there are really great artists that were working for the Shaw Brothers in the 60s and 70s, people like Chang Che, or, you know, people like John Woo, Johnny To, Jackie Chan, Sammo Hung, you know, these actually, you know, great and vital filmmakers, but their movies still get the same treatment that the Saturday afternoon, you know, Kung Fu movie did. And, you know, the main culprit that I like to rag on is Miramax, but yeah, we'll get to Miramax later when we talk about Tears of the Black Tiger.
Yes.
For now, we should let's talk about Kung Fu movies.
Well, I, for a second, I wanted to just briefly touch on another thing that happened this week, which gives hope to cinephiles, is someone discovered footage from a Buster Keaton short, The Blacksmith, that, you know, it's alternate footage that hasn't been seen. And I think the first reel or something is, like, totally different gags, totally different stuff. I haven't been able to watch it yet. It's online.
Huh. I hope it's better, because Blacksmith is one of my least favorite of Buster Keaton shorts.
Yeah, it's not one of my favorites either. But it's so great when, you know, like, I think it was the same people that found Metropolis, or the pieces of Metropolis. I could be wrong about that. But it's great when these things, you know, when you can see a director's vision, you know, even 100 years or, you know, 80 years later, you finally get to see the full piece of what someone was trying to do, you know. And there's so many movies that have been cropped by studios, and, you know, there's Magnificent Ambersons, Orson Welles' film, which we'll never see his version of it, which is, you know, a terrible travesty, and Greed, and all these other great films. So, you know, there's hope, you know. Some people are still trying to preserve the director's or the artist's vision, which is really great. Speaking of really great, yes, now we will talk about Kung Fu films. So, yeah, tying in with Duel of Fists and the Shaw Brothers stuff, we're picking our Cinema Essential film of Kung Fu. And, Sean, you've seen probably 100 times more Kung Fu films than I have.
I've seen a lot.
You are doing your Summer of Sammo right now.
Yeah, and you know, I keep watching them. I don't really know why. Like, I went into Scarecrow Video in Seattle the other day, and I was like, I was going to rent Duel of Fists because I need it for the show, and I'm like, I'm going to rent one other movie because I have all these movies on Netflix and Hulu that I want to watch that I haven't had time to watch, and then I left with six Shaw Brothers movies.
That's how it goes. You know, I've seen a fair share of Kung Fu movies. I mean, I'm not a complete, you know, amateur when it comes to this. You know, most of the Kung Fu stuff I've seen was under the influence of the hip-hop group, the Wu-Tang Clan. when I was, you know, 17, 18, and probably a lot of, you know, suburban white kids, you know, got interested in kung fu films from the Wu-Tang Clan. And the RZA, the mastermind of the group, is a huge kung fu fan, and he's very, very knowledgeable of kung fu cinema. And he, you know, he made his own film last year, Man with the Iron Fists.
Yeah, I haven't seen
it. I haven't seen it either. I'm kind of afraid to. But
I haven't heard anything that...
No, neither have I. So I, you know, I saw Master Killer. I saw, you know, a lot of the ones that the Wu-Tang samples on their records. I was like, well, I got to seek these out, you know, which is a good gateway drug. And so, but I definitely haven't seen as many of you as you. And I'm actually going to be very conservative with my pick, because sometimes the obvious choice is the right choice. And so I am actually going to pick Lau Kar-Lung's 36 Chamber of Shaolin, which I've seen more than any other kung fu film. I think it's the best. What I like about kung fu films, for me, I really like the training. To me, the training is the thing that really gets me excited. I like to see it, you know, pay out at the end of the film too, and all that stuff. But I really like the intensity and the drive and seeing how much effort is put into learning these really exotic, interesting moves and the dedication in a character to achieve these ends. And that's all 36 Chamber is. I mean, it's all just training, you know, for the most part.
Well, it's got like an intro where Gordon Liu's character is hounded by Manchu troops. Mm-hmm. And he goes into seclusion at the Shaolin Temple. And then this long, like hour-long middle section of the film is his training. To be a Shaolin master killer.
Yeah. And then the final, you know, the end of the movie, you see all of what he's trained. You see it in practice.
Yeah. What's great about 36 Chamber is not just the training sequences, but it's this idea of it's this conflict between going out and doing good for society versus leading a secluded life of contemplation in the temple. Mm-hmm. And it's this very real conflict at the heart of a lot of kung fu movies is whether or not the revenge is worth it, whether you can solve things through violence. And the Shaolin monks, one of their requirements is they have to withdraw from society. They have mm-hmm. to give up worldly concerns. This is part of their Buddhist faith.
Mm-hmm.
But they still see that the Manchu troops are doing these horrible wrong things, and they want to do right by, you know, the poor,
mm-hmm.
Oppressed people. So they invent a 36th chamber. Like, each chamber is a step along the path to being a true monk, and then they invent a 36th chamber, which is the world. So they send Gordon Liu out into the world to do good.
Yes. And it's just when we talked about Lau Kar-Lung on the first episode of the show, you know, we talked about 36 Chamber for a brief spell as kind of, it's a pivotal moment in cinema and in kung fu cinema. And it holds up today. I mean, it's just a fantastic film. What it kind of reminds me of, one of my favorite martial arts, it's not a film, it's a TV show. One of my favorite martial arts things ever is the Nickelodeon show Avatar: The Last Airbender. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've just seen the M. Night Shyamalan adaptation.
Oh, Sean, I'm so sorry. I did not see that because I've heard it's the worst movie ever made. But
it's not that bad.
I love Avatar: The Last Airbender, and the whole show. It's three seasons, and it's training, and you know it's supernatural because you know they can, you know, move air and water and all that stuff. But it has that same element of the training and the dedication and all that stuff that's in 36 Chamber, and I just love it to death. What is your pick for the Cinema Central Kung Fu film, Sean?
Well, you know, I'm not going to pick 36 Chamber because you did, but I would say if you've never seen a kung fu movie, that would be the one that I would recommend you start with. My pick for the Essential is, it might be the best. It was the first Chinese movie to get an award at Cannes, and that's King Hu's A Touch of Zen from 1971. You know, the title doesn't make a whole lot of sense because Zen is a Japanese variation on Buddhism. It's an American title. Americans are stupid. It's beside the point. King Hu is kind of along with Cheng Che, is one of the first great directors of the kung fu film in the new era. He started at Shaw Brothers with Come Drink With Me and had a big clash with the producers over how the movie was going to end. And so he ended up leaving Hong Kong and going to Taiwan, where he made a string of kung fu movies, the first of which was Dragon Gate Inn, which was a huge hit throughout Southeast Asia. You can see glimpses of it in Chai Ming Leong's Goodbye Dragon Inn.
Which is a very... It's not a kung fu movie.
It's not a kung fu movie, but it is the best movie ever made about working in a movie theater.
It is. I would say, although, you know, speaking of Buster Keaton, he does, you know, work in a movie theater in Sherlock Jr.
Yeah, but it's not about that. It's not about working in a movie theater.
I know. No, it is. No, it's Goodbye Dragon Inn is a fantastic film. But anyway, back to...
And he followed up Dragon Gate Inn with A Touch of Zen, which is his most ambitious movie. It's over 3 hours long. I think the original cut was like 4 hours long, and then it ended up getting chopped up. And it exists now in 187 or 200-minute versions, depending on how you count it.
Mm-hmm.
But it starts as kind of like a mystery thing where this guy's a scholar. And he uncovers some, like, fugitives from the government. Mm-hmm. Like, the secret agents are out to kill them because they're loyal to a general who opposed the corrupt practices. And it's the same basic plot setup as Dragon Gate Inn. But the scholar gets mixed up in it, and he ends up joining their fight against the killers. But the whole first hour of the movie is just kind of this character kind of comedy thing as he's, like, trying to figure out the mystery. It's not, like, a wacky comedy. It's more just light. But then it turns into an action movie as the bad guys attack, and he, you know, comes up with schemes to repel their invasion, and then it shows the aftermath of the fight, which you don't get in a lot of movies, because he's come up with these schemes to kill all of these soldiers, and then the next day he sees all of these bodies, and he's walking around, and he's laughing that his schemes have worked, but then he notices all of the bodies, and he starts to kind of realize...
The ramifications.
You know, the actual human cost,
right,
of this fight. And then the heroes go off to, the heroes that he had helped protect go off to a temple into seclusion. And then they get drawn out again by more bad guys who have come after them. And then the final hero ends up being this monk who just kind of defeats the bad guys with, like, his, you know, innate Buddha powers. After having this long talk with them about whether or not violence is the right way to solve things. So it starts as like this kind of very grounded mystery and becomes a meditation on violence and then becomes this really kind of spiritual transcendent view of the world. So it's a fascinating film. I've seen it like 3 times. I just saw it again the other day and I really want to watch it again.
Well, that's the highest praise you can give a film.
The problem with it is it's really hard to find. The only DVD that's out there is in really poor condition.
Mm.
And, you know, somebody needs to get the rights to the King Hu's movies and restore them and release them. I think there's only one that's actually available on DVD in North America, Region 1, and that's Come Drink With Me, which is a great movie, and it looks great, but it's not as good as Dragon Gate Inn or A Touch of Zen.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully someone will take on that task, grab that torch, and run with it.
Criterion,
yeah,
Cinema, Twilight Time, Shout Factory.
If you're listening, please help us. Well, that's great. I really need to see that, because you know, the glimpses that I've seen in Goodbye Dragon Inn were very tantalizing.
Yeah, it's one that David Wardwell writes about a lot when he writes about Hong Kong cinema. Like A Touch of Zen is one of his examples of, as a kind of a typical of the various tricks that Hong Kong directors will pull to show off their stunts and such. All right, with that, we're going to transition to our person of the week, who I think he made an action movie, but I haven't actually seen it. He like co-directed it. We're not going to talk about that one.
Okay.
That's A Peach Upon Wears Ethical, and... he's kind of the most famous of the kind of Thai new wave directors that have come around over the last 15 years or so, of which the director of Tears of the Black Tiger is another member of that group. He won the Palme d'Or at Cannes for Uncle Boon Mee, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, which is probably his most famous film to date. And it might be his best. I don't know. It's the only one that you've seen.
Yep. As I say week in, week out, I've got, you know, my watch list on Letterboxd is 580 something and growing, and all of his other films are in there. I do enjoy Uncle Boon Mee. But I kind of enjoy it from a distance. I don't, you know, when it was getting all these awards and I was getting really excited and that amazing poster that came out for it and stuff, I was basically foaming at the mouth to see this thing. And seeing it, I really did enjoy it, but I didn't love it. Like, I liked it. I liked a lot about it, but I didn't give myself completely over to it. But it is a very interesting film that needs to be seen.
Yeah, he has a lot of superficial similarity with a lot of kind of the Taiwanese minimalist directors with this very slow pace and long static shots, and kind of an oblique narrative that you're not really sure exactly what's going on. It doesn't really follow a conventional story structure. But he's different from somebody like a Ho Xiao-hsien or a Chai Ming-liang. He's much more supernatural. There's when I think of Ipichipong Wears Ethical Movies, I think of borders and like kind of the impermeability or the permeability of borders, the ability to cross between past and present and
spirit worlds and
the material and spiritual. And my favorite of his movies is Tropical Malady, which came out a few years before, I think 2004 2003. And it's got kind of a split narrative structure, like a lot of Hong Sang-soo movies will, where the first half is this kind of contemporary romance between these two boys who meet and like they work in an ice factory or something, and then that story abruptly ends, and then a new one begins where one of the boys is doing his military service in the jungle, and he has to go through and find he's getting stalked by a tiger. And it takes on all of these kind of weird spiritual and metaphorical, allegorical ramifications. Yeah, they're entrancing movies that are really hard to explain in words.
I think that's probably the best word to use is entrancing, because the two moments that I remember from Boon-mi, that will probably never leave me. You know, they are, you do feel it's you're in this heightened state or you know, it's the scene with this forest spirit with the red glowing eyes or whatever coming to dinner.
Or monkey god, right.
You know, and it's this languid scene that just kind of just lingers on this moment. And then at the very end of the film when they're, you know, kind of, I don't want to spoil it, but, you know, kind of outside of their bodies. And, you know, it's a very, entrancing is a really good way of putting it.
Yeah, his most recent film was Mekong Hotel, which I saw at Vancouver last year, and you know, another movie made on vacation. He actually filmed it while he and his actors were going to make this movie about like this demon that ate people's livers, but then I don't know if like the funding fell through or they were just waiting around. They filmed some of the scenes of like the demon eating the livers, but they're like actual people. And they filmed other scenes that are just like the actors and the director and the guy who did the score just kind of hanging around this hotel looking at the Mekong River as it flows by and just kind of talking about, you know, the history of the river, which like forms the border between Thailand and Laos. It's just kind of this languid, you know, slow-moving summer day by the riverside kind of movie, with this great score that just goes on and on constantly, just guitar playing. Reminded me more of the Mississippi than of, you know, any kind of exotic Asian environment or anything like that. It's a river culture.
Sure.
Movie. Yeah, and, you know, I love Ipichipong Wears Ethical movies. I have no idea how to talk or write about them.
Wasted everybody's time.
Yeah, I like the experience of being in the world that he creates on screen.
No, absolutely. I think that's a ringing endorsement, and I'm definitely looking forward to catching up with more stuff. Thai cinema in general, I think I've only seen, I could probably count them on one hand. You know, I haven't seen that many, but I do find them, you know, very interesting.
I would really recommend another of the Thai New Wave directors, Panek Ratnaroong, made a film called Last Life in the Universe around 2003, which is really terrific. It's about a librarian whose brother is a gangster, and the librarian ends up actually killing some gangsters and then going into hiding with this girl that he meets. And
it's like my life is playing out on screen.
Exactly. It's a really cool movie.
Cool. I will check that out. Well, speaking of the new wave, we are now going to get to our second feature of the week, Tears of the Black Tiger. And here is a clip. Oh.
ในห้วงเวหาดนี้ไปจรดจักรวาลอันกว้างใหญ่ประกายแห่งความสุขนิรันดร์ชิ้นนี้บังเกิดขึ้นได้เพียงครั้งเดียวเท่านั้นจากนี้ไปแม้แผ่นดินจะพังทลายร่างกายจะสูญสลายเป็นเท่าธุรีฉันก็จะขอรักเธอคนเดียวตราบจนลมหายใจสุดท้ายน้องผมเห็นไหลงามตาดวงดาวร้องร้องนภานาเพลินฤดีฟังเสียงคลื่นสัดฟังเรียบดุดังกับเสียงดนตรีบรรเลงกล้องร้อง
So that was a clip from Tears of the Black Tiger by director Wisit Sasanatiang, and you can kind of hear it in that clip, but the movie is an odd genre mashup of a kind of a western with a romantic melodrama. And what we just heard in the clip is gangsters riding on their horses with a kind of Ennio Morricone spaghetti western type theme, and then it cuts to a woman about to hang herself before this painted backdrop of a moon in this elaborately stylized room, and she's going to hang herself with this pretty red sash, and as a pop song plays on the soundtrack. So what the movie is this mashup of 60s action movies, not just spaghetti westerns, but also, you know, actual Thai
movies. It's like 10 different movies. I mean, scene to scene. It's really interesting.
It's mashed up with 50s style melodrama that Thai melodrama. But that also has, you know, relations to American melodrama.
I thought of Douglas Sirk, like, within the first 5 minutes of this
thing.
And
also Bollywood. Like, it seemed very much like a Bollywood movie to me. And that kind of fits Thailand's status as kind of like an in-between nation, in between India, in between China, in between the East and the West, and also its own unique culture. I think Thailand, I read somewhere, is the only nation of the world that wasn't colonized by Europeans. So it's got this fascinating mix of cultures that it's uniquely its own thing, which makes it difficult for us to talk about because we don't know nothing about Thai culture.
Yeah, I really don't. I do love Thai food.
and you know, And that's part of the problem that you know, American critics have in talking about these movies, and they can be really condescending to Asian movies that they don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to try to avoid doing that. As critics, we can only talk about a movie through our own frame of reference. So,
absolutely.
So when we watch Tears of the Black Tiger, we see Sergio Leone and we see Douglas Sirk.
Yeah.
We don't see like the actual 50s melodramas that Wisit Sasanatiang is actually referring to, and that's okay. That's the only way we have to discuss it.
Right.
But this is how Peter Bradshaw, writing in the British newspaper The Guardian, described Tears of the Black Tiger. It's quoted on Wikipedia. He said, "A stir-fry horse opera and an uproarious high camp cowboy drama."
He stole my line.
Which Yeah, I don't know that it's possible to be more condescending.
Yeah, that's really bad.
While ostensibly praising a film.
Yeah, that's really bad. That's the most backhanded way you could possibly say it.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know what it is. Like the food metaphors that they get used to describe Asian movies just always rub me the wrong way. Like Kong Kung Fu movies, chop sake.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, as Americans and Western Europeans, the only frame of reference we have for Asian culture is the food.
Yeah, no, it's true.
I think we can do better than that. I think we have to strive to take movies more seriously, and that gets to what we were talking about with dubbing and cutting movies. They're not taken seriously as legitimate works of art or legitimate works of cinema. Even like you wouldn't allow, you know, The Godfather to be redubbed and cut down to 100 minutes
unless you're George Lucas.
Or Harvey Weinstein.
Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah, they're treated as disposable. They're treated as, you know, fodder. They're treated as, you know,
yeah, just... American genre films, American B-movies, have been treated as art since, you know, the late 50s and the early 60s. But that same cultural status isn't ascribed to genre movies from other countries, specifically Asian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really frustrating as a fan of Asian cinema.
I'm sorry, Sean. I'm here to console you. Yeah, I mean, it's ignorance, and I, you know, I will come out and plead my ignorance here. You know, I mean, the touchstones that I have for this film are mostly Western cinema. What I find interesting about seeing movies from other countries, whether it's Thailand or India or, you know, even London or something, is it's a window to a different culture, and it's a way for me to see how, you know, philosophies of certain areas and how, you know, they live their lives and their passions and their, you know, and to me, as a person that can't travel everywhere I want to go, you know, I'm slowly putting pennies in the jar to get to Japan before I die. But, you know, it's a really good way of expanding your horizons and discovering new worlds and increasing your knowledge of cultures, you know, beyond your immediate grasp.
Yeah, and you know, I think in order to do that with films, you have to be willing to take them on their own terms.
Absolutely.
And not say, you know, this movie does not fit the specific genre template that was developed in Hollywood in the 1940s. Therefore, it is flawed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this Western, there's too much melodrama in my Western, or there's too much Western in my melodrama. You know, this movie doesn't fit. Therefore, you know, it's incompetently made.
Oh,
which I don't think is further from the truth.
Is that an argument that's being made about this?
I don't know that it's been made about this film specifically, but I have seen it in reference to many an Asian film.
Yeah, that's just ludicrous. I mean, well, let's talk about this film then. Let's talk about what we can about this film with our frame of reference that we've got. Now that we've made this long preamble, you know,
let's step down off my soapbox, and we'll talk about, you know, the movie we're here to talk about.
I think this is a really fun film. You know, I don't think all of it works. I was surprised because in the States, at least, it was promoted as a Thai Western, and it's not a Western. I mean, there's very little bits of it that are Western. I think it's just as, like you said, just as much a melodrama.
There are horses and there are guns.
Yeah, but there are also bazookas and there are, you know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean,
it's set in the 50s.
Right. And yeah, like you said, it's a mashup. It's not just melodrama and Western. It's, you know, there's one scene that feels like a greaser film or something, you know, where these thugs come upon this young couple and they, you know, kind of peacock around and you know, threaten them and stuff. And there's a scene that feels like, you know, that's a horror film for, you know, 2 minutes on screen when, you know, you see skulls and snakes coming out of nostrils and stuff. I mean, this movie, this movie is just a whole bunch of fun. Like, it's, you know, it's, you can tell that the filmmakers love just the entire scope of cinema and are investing, you know, each scene with their love of cinema. And it's very infectious and it's very fun and it's beautiful to look at, and there's some really striking shots here. I mean, I think, to me, I love these painted sets. You know, they're really, you know, eye popping.
Yeah, there's these like hallucinatory pinks and greens, and there's painted backdrops of like a sun that looks like an eyeball staring at like the hero, and it's just
they're very artificial, but their artificiality heightens the entire thing and makes it really exciting.
Yeah, it's a beautiful movie. It's about this guy, Dom, who's a gunfighter, and he's in love with the girl, the daughter of the local governor, and they're separated, and then they try to get back together, and then they're separated again, and then they try to get back together.
Yes.
And Dom's gangsters are trying to kill her fiance, who's like the captain of the troops who led an assault against them, and Dom kind of has to save the girl and defeat the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's all of these other things that you mentioned. Like, when we talked about Duel of Fists, we talked about it following, like, a very specific genre template with just kind of some doodling in the margins.
Mm-hmm.
With Assassinatiang here is following, like, 8 different genre templates, mm-hmm. and mixing them all together and creating something that's wholly unique and doesn't look like anything else anyone has ever made. But it interests me, this thing that you said about the skulls and the snakes, because that was not in the version that I saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I watched this on Netflix.
Oh, Sean.
And the Netflix version is Miramax originally purchased the movie after it came out in 2000. It won an award at the Vancouver Film Festival for like the best young director, which they give out every year and has a prestigious list of winners. Miramax bought it, they recut it, and then they shelved it for years,
mm-hmm.
and it just sat there and didn't get distributed at all. And then Magnolia bought the rights from them and put out the original uncut version in theaters, you know, briefly in 2006, I think, which is when I saw it. It played at the Seven Gables Theater, and we did like an employee screening of it, and mm-hmm. it was pretty crazy.
but rewatching it, you saw.
But them. In rewatching it for this podcast. I watched the stream on Netflix Instant, and Netflix gets their stream from Miramax, and that's the streaming version is the cut Miramax version that never played, that's only like 83 minutes long.
Oh.
As opposed to the 110 minute version that is the actual running time of the film.
Yeah. Oh, that's horrible. You so missed out.
In addition to some missing scenes, I think there's like some comic relief that's cut out, and the scene with the snakes. It also has a happy ending.
That's probably the most egregious part of the film. Because to me, what I like about this movie is it does have these, you know, there's these bit characters that are really funny and stuff. And the movie, you know, is artificial and it has these, you know, kind of pop art, you know, things going on in it and stuff. But it ends on such a somber and shockingly emotional note, because our hero Dom gets shot and he dies, you know. Yeah. he is shot, you know, he's reaching into his jacket to pull out the photograph of his, you know, the love of his life who's there, and he's gonna, you know, pull it out, and but the villain thinks he's pulling for a gun and shoots him right, you know, in the heart, right through the picture, and he falls down, and it's I kind of sat up when I watched that part, and it was a really wonderful ending to this film, because it shows you that these aren't just goofy, you know, trashy pictures. Like, there's, you know, there's some emotional weight to this.
And yeah. Depth of feeling that goes into the making of these movies, even if they are, you know, they do have, you know, bullets shattering teeth.
Right, exactly. Wow, that's really...
Yeah, in the Miramax ending, he shoots the
his blood brother.
Yeah, his blood brother who has betrayed him.
Uh-huh.
They have like the standoff, and like a raindrop falls through his hat,
right.
the bad guy's hat, and gets in his eye, and Dom shoots him, and then he takes the girl, and they walk off, and the credits roll. And it leaves you with. With the captain of the troops, the fiance is still alive, and you're like,
what happened to that plot?
What about that guy?
That is horrible. My God, that's horrible. Well, I must stress, if you want to see this movie, which you should, it's, you know, it's not amazing. I don't, you know, I gave it a 3 on Letterboxd, which is, you know, I had a pleasurable, enjoyable time with it. Since it does do so many different things, certain things, you know, are better than others, I think, in this, or at least, you know, responded, you know, better for me with this. But if you're going to see this movie, seek out the DVD, which on the box it does say uncut version.
The Magnolia DVD. And Magnolia was a sister company to us when we worked for Landmark.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of obnoxious things. But one of the good things they did is put out the correct version of Tears of the Black Tiger. Yeah, you want to avoid Miramax whenever possible when renting Asian genre cinema, because this was what they did. They would buy up the rights to all kinds of movies, not just you know, Thai or Hong Kong movies, but movies from all over the world, and then they would recut them according to what Harvey Weinstein thought the public would want, and then decide to not release them at all. Zhang Yimou's Hero was made in with Jet Li and Tony Leung and Maggie Cheung was made in 2002. It didn't get released in the U.S. until like 3 years later, in a recut Harvey Weinstein version. To this day, there are versions of movies that Miramax has the rights to that you can't get not dubbed in the U.S. because they won't allow the original versions to be put out, like Lau Kar-Lung's Drunken Master 2, which is one of the great kung fu movies of all time. I mean, it would have been a perfectly fine choice as a Cinema Central.
Mm-hmm.
You can only get the Miramax version of it on DVD in the U.S. And you can't get the original Cantonese soundtrack.
Well, and they also, you know, yeah. They make some stupid choices with the dubbing, too. And I avoid dubbing at all costs. But I think the first time I saw Miyazaki's Princess Mononoke, which was released Miramax in the States, the first time I saw that, I saw the English version. And there's this character in there, this kind of squat, you know, guy, you know, and he's voiced by Billy Bob Thornton. And the character is Japanese, and hearing the twang of Billy Bob Thornton completely ruined the entire movie for me.
Yeah,
it's just the dumbest, stupidest thing you could do.
Yeah, and they do it, you know, ostensibly to make it more palatable for American audiences.
Right, but it's like, the most...
When Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out in around Christmas 2000 and was a big hit, Miramax suddenly realized that, hey, maybe people like kung fu movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they started putting out more versions. They re-released Wen Wuping's Iron Monkey, which is another one of the great kung fu movies. But it's a movie with a very specific, you know, kind of political context and point that it wanted to make. So when Miramax released it, they did a dubbed version.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have a subtitled version, and the movie's recut, and the subtitles deliberately mistranslate the actual Cantonese dialogue in order to minimize the political content of the film.
Yeah, it's just egregious. It's a terrible, terrible practice, and
they're the worst. They're a bane on cinema.
a plague. I curse them. A plague upon their kingdom, as it were.
Yeah, and, you know, I come across this a lot in Hong Kong movies, but I wasn't really expecting it with Tears of the Black Tiger, and I probably should have when I saw the Miramax logo at the beginning.
Yeah,
but
yeah, that's really unfortunate.
And I don't know why they would cut that stuff out. Like, I remember the stuff from the theatrical release, and it played perfectly fine. The audiences loved it. You know, it had a dark ending, but who needs happy endings? It's like where the studio executives and the player. It's like,
yeah,
it's got to have a happy ending.
Yeah, no, it's unfathomable to me. I mean, it really is. But
you know, let's get back to Tears of the Black Tiger a little bit, and
you know what my favorite part about this movie is?
Shoot.
My favorite part of Tears of the Black Tiger is actually the music.
Yeah,
I think the music through the whole film, and the music, like the images and the story and the characters, it comes from all different sides. Like, it's, you know, you got your Thai pop, you've got your, you know, ballads, you've got your country western kind of songs, you've got your
little hints of Ennio Morricone, Sergio Leone music.
Yeah, you've got all that stuff, and all of it is fantastic. Like, I wish I owned the soundtrack, because it really carries a lot of those scenes where there aren't a lot, there isn't a lot of dialogue, but these songs kind of tell what's going on, and they really help the shift of the mood. You know, as you said, you know, with the clip we played, it shifts from, you know, a Western thing right into this melodrama, and the music throughout, I think, is just phenomenal, and some really, really good songs on it.
Yeah, I love the just the audaciousness of it all, just the willingness to mix, to throw all this stuff together with these, you know, oversaturated colors, and mm-hmm. you know, there's like poems that get written on the screen, mm-hmm. and you know, there's these phony backdrops and this crazy, like, violent ricochet shots,
right.
that you know, gets replayed. With like a title that comes up, and like, did you see that?
We'll run it again.
Let's check it again,
yeah.
And then you see like all the
bullets ping ponging,
bounces off before it hits some guy. And yeah, you know, I like movies that are free to do whatever the director imagines,
right?
Like that show that just anything is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes it exhilarating, and it keeps your interest throughout the whole thing, because you know every story's been told a zillion times, but it's just how you tell it. And I've never seen anything quite like this movie, even though I've seen so many things like this movie. You
right.
know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a fun little film, and you should definitely check it out. With that, we're going to segue into some more Thai pop. This is Chele Chayata and Sawani Patana doing a song with what might be my favorite song title of all time, You Should Die by Bullets.
So what, D Club?
You Should Die by Bullets, which is just totally awesome. That's the Thai Pop Spectacular Comp, Volume 1, which is put out by Seattle label Sublime Frequencies. There's also a Volume 2, which I do not have yet, but I really enjoy this compilation, so you should check it out. Next week on the show, we are going to be taking a flight back from Bangkok. We'll be landing at SFO in San Francisco, tying in with Woody Allen's new film Blue Jasmine, which, you know, I think the last 10 years of Woody Allen films now, the big story is where the hell Woody Allen shot the film, which is kind of weird, but he's
well,
not
in New York for so long.
I know,
but
it's kind of beating a dead horse at this point.
Well,
he's moved from London to wherever, to, you know, so anyway, he's in San Francisco this time, people. It's going to be crazy. But we're tying it in by doing two films set in San Francisco, my old stomping ground. I look forward to watching these. We're going to do Otto Preminger's film noir Whirlpool and Phil Alden Robinson's 1992 thriller Sneakers, which I saw many times as a kid, and I look forward to revisiting.
Yeah, I haven't seen that in
20 years.
15 years
yeah. or so. Speaking of San Francisco, Sean, you wanted to mention...
Yeah, if you're in the San Francisco area, you should go to the Pacific Film Archive and check out the Raoul Walsh series they got going on. Coming up on July 24th, they're playing Raoul Walsh's They Died With Their Boots On, in which Errol Flynn plays General George Custer. And awesome. It is completely ahistorical. It has absolutely nothing to do with reality, but it is a great film nonetheless.
Yeah, who needs reality, right?
Yeah.
That sounds like a great pick. This week for me, speaking of vacations that we've talked about throughout the show and stuff, I'm on vacation starting today for a week. I'm leaving the library and heading out into the Pacific Northwest, and I'm encouraging everybody to, if you can, if it's possible, go seek out a drive-in movie somewhere. I'm planning on going up to Bremerton to the Rodeo Drive-In. I will probably see The Lone Ranger, but you know, I've been going to the drive-in in Washington for a few years running now. It's kind of a tradition to go at least once during the summer and usually see a trashy film because that's what you do, you know. But the one nearby, the Valley Six in Auburn, closed last year because most drive-ins are dying now because they need to upgrade to digital projection. And if they can't afford it or they can't get the funds and what have you, they got to shut down because 35 prints are not being made anymore. So there are a few still lingering about. And so if you have a drive-in near you, mine's an hour and a half away, but I'm still going to go see something at the drive-in this week.
I used to go see drive-ins all the time when I was a kid. When I was really little, my mom took us to a James Bond quadruple feature.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I made it through like one and a half movies.
Yeah.
My favorite drive-in was a double feature of Terminator 2 and Unforgiven.
Which one? Did Terminator 2 play first?
I think Unforgiven played first.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
I think that's probably a better choice. Yeah, usually we go with the intention of seeing both films, but most of the time, especially with what's out there now, there is rarely a double feature that I'm willing to sit through. You know, I think we saw... You know, I think one year we went and the second movie was one of those Twilight things and we're like, we're out. I think it was like Inception and Twilight or something like that.
Well, it's just, you can't win. You can't.
I know. I did see Premium Rush last year, which was pretty fun at the drive-in. But anyway, yeah, go seek out a drive-in. I'm sure there's got to be one in your state if you're in the States. And yeah, so that's the plan. You can find us on the internet at thegeorgesandersshow.blogspot.com. We're also on the Twitter at geosandersshow. There are links on our website to our respective blogs, to our Letterboxd profiles, and there's a calendar for upcoming shows, and I think we've planned the week after next week as well. So hopefully we'll you know, be a few weeks ahead of the game there, so you can play along at home if you want to.
Yeah, you can also send us comments or questions or incoherent rants at...
I do it to Sean all the time, so...
TheGeorgeSandersShow.gmail.com or at gmail.com?
At gmail.com. Yeah, we keep meaning to mention that. We'd love to hear feedback if anybody's got it. So, TheGeorgeSandersShow@gmail.com.
Or you can leave us a comment on the website or a review on the iTunes or whatever.
Or at the Twitter... or whatever you people do on your Twitters. So without further ado, we're going to move on to George Sanders, who will take us away like he does every week. Go for it, George.
A kiss is just a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely. No matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Moonlight and love songs, never out of date. Hearts full of passion, jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die.